This nation was founded on the principle that all men are created equal.
We hold these truths to be self-evident.
That all men are created equal.
I'll tell you what freedom is to me. No fear. I mean, really, no fear.
Created equal.
Welcome to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm in the studio with Carey Jr. II. He is the show's producer.
How you doing, Stephen?
Sometimes when I'm watching what's happening on the news around here, I get a little lost in a thought about what it means in a bigger sense. And that happened recently when Judge Kenneth King, who is a judge at the 36th District Court in Detroit, reacted to a teenager sleeping in his courtroom, a teenager who was on a field trip, by having her dress in prison garb and be handcuffed,
right,
as a way of teaching her a lesson about respect. And look, it's an outrageous reaction, and what he did is unacceptable. But it made me think about the way in which people respond to signs of distress from other people. And in particular, it made me think about how people respond to signs of distress from poor people. It turned out that this young woman, this 15-year-old girl, was tired because she and her mother don't have permanent housing, and they move around a lot. And they were out late the night before trying to get to the place that they were going to be able to sleep. Now, the judge had no way of knowing that, of course. But I think there are lots of instances where we're encountering people, and especially young people, who are having trouble with something for a reason. And instead of punishing them for the behavior, that what it challenges us to do is really think about the circumstances that their lives exist in and to deal with those things. And so I thought we should spend some time on the show talking about that. How do we respond to poverty when we see it? How should we respond to poverty when we see it? And what are the things that people who live in poverty deal with that cause them, in some cases, to exhibit things that we might interpret as laziness or disrespect,
right,
or something else that we think needs to be punished?
That's interesting. I mean, it definitely, I think, is worth us re-examining our perceptions of folks who are in challenging circumstances. But I do think it's kind of a hard, it's a hard variable to identify, right? Because how do you know someone is in poverty when you see them in distress? How do you not only just see the distress behavior? And how much of the behavior that people who live in poverty exhibit are also in alignment with other circumstances that might require, or maybe it is an appropriate response to feel disrespected? Like, I don't know the balance between those two.
I actually think there isn't a balance. I actually think, especially when you're dealing with young people, any sign of distress is worthy of your inquiry and empathy more than it's worthy of your ire or desire to mete out consequence. I mean, young people don't act irrationally, right? They respond to their environment. And if something in their environment is causing them to do something, it's worth your time to figure out what that is.
As opposed to thinking it's their fault.
As to just jumping to the conclusion that it's their fault and that the best thing you can do is punish them for what they're doing. You know, I think there's a reflex almost in some people and in some parts of our culture that say that's how, you know, be tough on them and show them that the world is tough and won't accept the behavior that they're exhibiting. But I don't think that works. And I think that that tends to make them feel unseen and unworthy. And that's certainly what happened in the case of this judge in this courtroom.
Yeah, I mean, it is unfair to expect someone in the adolescent stages to be self-aware enough to regulate their emotions. Like, after a certain age, I don't know, we all kind of generally say once our brains are fully developed.
And well, that's not until 26.
Right, your mid to late 20s. that's when you can probably hold people to more account for their behavior, mm-hmm. because then they have kind of more of the rational decision making where mm-hmm. you can say, okay, you know, or you've consciously made this choice. And so I get that. And it, I guess this maybe comes from, it sounds like it comes from like a parenting perspective too.
Yes.
Like, I mean, growing up, I didn't get that. That would have been nice. Right. I've had parents who were like, oh, you're misbehaving. Let's figure out what's going on in your world.
Right.
That's putting you in this circumstance.
There's a difference between misbehavior, I think, and parenting as in a way to prevent your children from misbehaving and reacting to, environmental stimulus that causes things that seem like misbehavior, and it is harder
mm-hmm.
to respond to it in a way that that is about empathy. But I think it's incumbent on us to do it, especially in a city like Detroit, where you've got 60-70% of the kids who live here, who live in poverty, who mm-hmm. live in circumstances mm-hmm. that are going to cause them to behave differently than other children. And I think it always surprises me a little when I see somebody in Detroit react to young people in a way that seems to ignore that or not acknowledge it in the right way. So on today's show, we want to start talking with some people who think about this and who study this. And we've got a great guest, Dr. Rima Vassar. She's a professor of educational leadership and policy studies. She's also spent 20 years as a teacher, a counselor, and a principal, which has given her an up-close look at all of these issues. Dr. Rima Vassar, it's great to have you here in the studio. Welcome to Created Equal.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me and thinking of me. I appreciate you.
Sure.
And thank you. Carrie was awesome. So thank you for that.
So let's start by talking about how your experience in academia informs the way that you see class and poverty show up in education, in the ways that children who are living in poverty, of which we have way too many in the city of Detroit, for instance, kind of exhibit things that are about that impoverished background when they show up at the school door.
Yeah. So I look at this from not just the perspective of a professor, but I've been a teacher, a counselor, a president, a parent, and a student who didn't really know that she was poor. Like, you know, you have those. We were talking about Catholic school. I didn't know I was on scholarship, right? I thought that I was just like everyone else mm-hmm. in rural Michigan, mm-hmm. right? So class is the great equalizer in terms of inequality in a lot of ways, right? So I think about schools and I think about those children who come from an environment that has less, that has lack. And we see that there's all kinds of issues that come with poverty. Mm-hmm. So physiological issues, there's more stress in those environments. Allostatic load is that like compounding of stress. We see young children with inattention, a lack of security and on any front, home, housing, food, not even being able to bring school supplies that we were just talking about, will cause stress. And that stress then has all kinds of physiological responses that could then translate into not being able to stay on task. Not worrying about the future necessarily, thinking about what's happening right now because the immediate needs are more important and pressing. So not just not having food, because we've done a lot across the nation and in Michigan to make sure that people have free lunch and free breakfast when they get to school, which I think is just a human right, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So not necessarily coming to school without something to eat, but not coming to school ready to only think about academics when you have life's pressures on you, from poverty, it makes it very difficult to attend.
Yeah. So one of the things that always strikes me about this is, I mean, it is, of course, in absolute terms, unfair that some children grow up in poverty. But the unfairness is an adult unfairness, right? It's their parents who are struggling for whatever reason and can't provide more than what they are for their kids. And yet it's the kids who suffer those consequences. There's something even more unfair, I think, about that.
Yeah, so I was thinking so much about Eva Goodman, the 15-year-old who just got spotlighted about her housing insecurity. And I think about her mother, and I thought about, you know, her mother on the news. Her mother's putting herself at a lot of risk, right, to speak out and protect her daughter. So even in poverty, when you're thinking about all the rules and regulations, and we know people who live in poverty actually follow more rules than anybody else. They're very rule conscious, very strict with their children, have very limited freedoms, and are very attentive to the rules and guidelines.
And as kids who grew up in poverty, we understand that. But explain to the listeners why that's true. Why are poor people more likely to follow rules and have structure? Because that's not what most people who aren't poor think about.
Really?
Poor people. Absolutely. I think there's this perception that there's a lack of discipline.
Oh.
There's a lack of attention. There's a lack of structure. I mean, most people, I think, blame poor people for their circumstances and as an extension believe that, you know, they live in a way that would never get them to something better.
Oh, yeah. So we do. We think of poverty as an individual sport, right? Like that somehow, and it is deceptive because it is often generational, right? And so it looks like, oh, these folks are just in a cycle and they're not ever going to get out. Well, these are systemic issues creating individual experiences, right? And so this idea that people who are poor folks like how I grew up are somehow amoral,
yes,
or have low boundaries. Yeah, so I think there's a classism that's happening there.
Sure.
Do they make the same decisions the same way that someone who didn't have the stressor of poverty? No, right? If I'm thinking about my next meal, if I'm thinking about where I'm going to put my children for the evening, as Eva Goodman was thinking about, right? Where am I going to sleep tonight? I'm not doing estate planning, right? Like, that's not the order of the day.
Yeah,
like,
right.
There's immediate needs. And so it looks irrational to someone who is doing estate planning. Mm-hmm. It looks like it's impulsive to someone who, you know, has a long history of being able to not worry about where their next meal is coming from. But it makes complete sense for those who are living in the moment.
Yeah.
And they're more policed. And when I say that, not just law enforcement, I'm talking about in schools.
Yes.
So that mother advocating for her daughter, you know, there's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. There's basic needs that everyone has to meet. And for students, food, clothing, shelter, these are parents' responsibilities. If you're not meeting those responsibilities, they call the people.
Mm-hmm.
Child Protective Services
will
come to your door because you cannot take care of your child adequately. So her saying, you know, my daughter was wronged, we didn't know where we were going to sleep that night. Already, ding, for mandated reporters, I'm a mandated reporter at the college level all the way to preschool. Everyone is a mandated reporter. If you see abuse, and that's what we would call that, you would have to call and have someone go and possibly take the child from the mother because she's not able to take care of her child.
So even speaking out
about
what happened to her daughter in this courtroom is, as you say, taking a risk that someone could call CPS and she could lose her daughter.
Because of poverty. Not obviously because it's not because she's not a good mom, right. Because she's on TV right. saying you to
you
a judge.
Should have done this to my kid.
To the highest level of enforcement, which yeah. we know
right.
people who are living in poverty are going to follow the rules. They're trying to do the right thing. They're not trying to bring attention. So for her to go on the news and say to the highest levels, right, to the courts, hey, listen, this was wrong. She's a great mom.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But by our standards, which is a middle class standard mm-hmm. For everything. Every institution is normed on middle classness. Every single institution, health, and we could talk about race too. But it's
right. But that's part of this.
You can't. I'm a critical race theorist, and we think about the intersection of race and class. Mm-hmm. And so, what happens for low income white students is not the same that happens for low income black students. Disproportionately, we are separated from our families. Because the CPS is called on us,
right?
Right? Disproportionately. Same conditions, different skin, right? And even this idea of disrespect, like she was seen as disrespectful. Mm-hmm. When I was at UCLA doing my PhD work, my advisor used to say all the time, all behavior is functional. There's a reason for all behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So if the baby is sleeping
right.
in the court,
right.
the human response is to figure out why, right?
Right. I think for most of us, that would have been the instant response. Why is this 15-year-old, who's old enough to know what she's doing and where she is, why is she so tired today that mm-hmm. she can't take advantage of what we're doing? I mean, they brought these children to this courtroom on a field trip, to teach them about the court system,
yeah.
to expose them to this part of our lives, of our government. And you've got one child out of all of them mm-hmm. who's so tired, she can't participate. As a parent, when I see another child that's not mine struggling with something, my instant response is, oh, what's going on with this kid? It's not, oh, this kid is being disrespectful it's not about me. It doesn't instantly become about me. It becomes about them. Mm-hmm. And that always, when I think about this judge and his response, mm-hmm. I have a really hard time even getting to that initial reaction
of disrespect.
This is disrespect. Mm-hmm. Like, it's just not the way. It's not the way I would have seen it, and I don't think it's the way most parents would have seen it. I don't think it's the way most people necessarily would have seen it.
Yeah, I would hope that would be true, right? Knowing that the frontal cortex, the lobe here, the prefrontal cortex is not even developed.
They're not like even adults, right?
They can't even think about what's happening next week, and yeah, so for her to be able to put together, oh, I'm sleeping now. He's going to read that as disrespect. I'm going to be in a jumpsuit, like impossible. Right. And so that part, right, the humanity should have. But we see low income, black and brown folks living in low income housing as criminalized mm-hmm. at a very early age.
Yes. Right.
Right. So there was a moratorium in 2019 in California. We can no longer expel 3 and 4-year-old mm-hmm. black and brown boys mm-hmm. who were in Head Start. Right. Head Start is for low income folks.
Yeah.
They were expelling 3 and 4-year-old babies. And so you can't sleep as a 15-year-old, which they need more sleep than any other human walking mm-hmm. on the earth, by the way, teenagers do. Then certainly at a 4-year-old age, you're not going to be able to throw, kick, right? Things that normal 4-year-olds do. But I think the disrespect piece is so key because there's a reason for what we are, as adults saying, this is disrespectful.
Mm-hmm.
If we read her disrespect as disappointment, how could that have been a different outcome?
Right.
However you're saying, okay, I feel disrespected, right, for whatever reason, however that lands. Okay. Most children aren't disrespectful. They're disappointed, right? These are systemic failures that they're being subjected to.
Mm-hmm.
And so if that were true, if we saw her as someone who was disappointed, wouldn't there be empathy and compassion and maybe a let's try to figure something out,
right.
problem solving
right.
Around her in a different way. But we shame and humiliate the poor folks in our community. It's their personal failing.
And this judge, that was his reaction, right? This person is being disrespectful. I'm going to teach her a lesson about respect. And the lesson is going to be that when you are disrespectful, I'll humiliate you. I'll embarrass you in front of all of your peers and everyone in this courtroom. I mean, I can get really worked up about what this judge was thinking and how he acted. But I do think it's reflective of a larger problem that we have with the way we see poverty.
Yep.
When we see signs of poverty, how so many of us sometimes react. Now, I don't understand how you do it with a child. I think that should have put this in an entirely different category for the judge. This wasn't a 25-year-old.
It was a baby.
In front of him in the court for a judicial matter. This was a kid on a field trip. I mean, I don't know how you'd get to that space there. But even for the 26-year-old who's accused of a crime and is in front of that judge and is exhibiting behaviors that are really about poverty rather than criminality, I think, we need judges and other people of authority to be able to make that distinction and react appropriately.
I agree.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to continue this conversation. We'll be right back with more Created Equal. We are back with more Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm talking today with Dr. Rima Vassar. She is a professor of educational leadership and policy studies at Wayne State University. We're talking about the way we all react when we see someone who is struggling with poverty. Let's get back to the conversation. So the other thing that occurs to me out of this particular incident with the judge and the 15-year-old is what he did to her and the effect that that has going forward, right? So I don't think I'm in the minority of African Americans by admitting that I've had a police officer put handcuffs on me before. And I can remember that moment.
Of terror?
Yeah, and that feel of that steel against your wrists and the restraint that results. I mean, it's different than any other experience you might have. Having that as a 15-year-old, when you hadn't done anything, and when you're on a field trip with friends, with people who you're socially interacting with, I really struggle with what effect that has. And this is someone who also, of course, is living in a challenged situation, probably dealing with all kinds of other things that we don't know about. I don't know how you undo that.
You don't. So this this young girl, the mother was out doing, press conferences, and she said, I would really want her to be here with me, but she won't. She's not coming out of any house. Mm-hmm. She's embarrassed, ashamed, and humiliated. And I thought about the first day of school. It's already difficult when you don't have the latest and greatest clothes, right? These kids,
yeah.
having spent 11 years at the middle school level, they're very
rough.
And they're slick, right? They're creative in the ways that they could talk about you. So I'm saying that she's probably already struggling to maintain a semblance of normalcy around her peers and to be seen as one of them. Now she's been outed.
Yeah.
Right. Even if she could afford the nicest pair of shoes to come and get to get her hair braided and to look like everyone else, mm-hmm. quote unquote. Mm-hmm. At this point, nationally, she's been outed as someone who's different, as someone who is poor.
Yeah.
And that has a stain on it that I think couples that of criminality. She was there on a field trip to learn about courts. What lesson do you think she took back?
Yeah.
Right? And that's why this moratorium on the young babies was so important. This is, you enter into a pipeline. Mm-hmm. Some folks say that there's not even a pipeline. It's just school and prison are about
they're
the
merged,
same. There's
right.
a nexus, right? And there's their school is prison. But you have a pipeline, and there's a direct correlation between those who are suspended, those who are expelled, out of school time, and jail time.
Yeah.
86% of all the folks who are in prison are illiterate, right? Like, because they spent so few days in school. Mm-hmm. So there's all these connections with the criminal justice system or injustice system in this case. And this young girl got a lesson about unfairness, mm-hmm. right? Because none of that was fair. That was an overreaction to even this. I don't know what kind of disrespect she could have given him that would warrant being changed into a jumpsuit, mm-hmm. put into a cell, and humiliated before all of your friends. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. So she learned a lesson about more about poverty and what it means to have that stain and stigma on you. And then more about then what that means when you have to go into court and trust a system that's supposed to look out for you.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to actually be fair and have some empathy and compassion and get to the why mm-hmm, of your behavior. She's seeing very clearly that's not what we've set up in this United States. Mm-hmm. And it's especially not going to be true for her and yeah. people who look like her.
Yeah. So what about the judge here? I also spent a lot of time thinking about him and the way he reacted. But you know, I also think about who he is and the role he plays here and how I wouldn't have expected this judge in this city to react that way. I mean, this is not the first time he's seen poor people in front mm-hmm. of him. He sees it every day.
Mm-hmm.
He's African-American like she is. He probably has some of the same experiences that she's had. And yet, for him, there was this instant most anger about what this young girl was doing in his courtroom. I think that's really the only word I could imagine would inspire what he does, is that he was angry about it. And he punishes her. He punishes her in an outsized way publicly.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do?
What
do we do with people like this? You know,
I don't know that we can sum up who he is in this one experience, right?
Of course.
I don't know him personally. I've been reading a lot about what happened because I was just like, what? And he's well respected. Now, let's go back to what we said earlier about people who are living in poverty wanting to follow the rules
mm-hmm.
and being strict parents, right?
Mm-hmm.
To the point of, I think, overbearing, right? Black children can't be free a lot of times. He's in a system, I'm in a system where we know that Black and brown children are going to face a different reality.
Yes.
Low-income Black and brown children are going to be.
Especially.
Yes. And so it's almost, and I'm not saying, I can't speak for him, but this is from an outside perspective. being in schools with Black educators, with Black children who have these similar responses, mm-hmm. right? Over the top discipline.
Yes.
Right. It's almost out of protection. So Black parents are especially strict because they, do you ever, did you, I don't know if you ever got that speech about, I'm going to whoop you now so you don't get whooped.
So you don't end up in jail.
Yes, right. By the police. And absolutely. So, and so it's counterintuitive, in my opinion, but it's really a protective yeah. mechanism. I'm going to, and he said it, I'm going to show her, you know, what can happen if she is disrespectful.
She's disrespectful.
Yeah. In a court.
It's an interesting way to think about it. It's a little more compassionate
well,
way
he to think also, about it. Because I couldn't wrap my mind around him then offering to mentor her.
This is your mentor, right?
What has she already learned from you,
right?
And what does she want to learn further?
What more could she gain from this, right?
But in his mind, I think he was thinking of...
He was teaching her.
Yes, and protecting her and mentoring her and molding her and shaping her and making sure that she doesn't get in trouble later on, which I think are the last vestiges of... plantation politics.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, that is a sickness inside the culture that goes way back, right?
It's an anti-Black racism that is pathological in that we have taken on our own, we've taken on the tools of the oppressor in order to regulate ourselves.
Wow.
Yeah, so...
So that's not better. That's worse. That's worse, right? I mean, it's not better than the overreaction. I mean...
It's explanative.
Yeah. Yeah. Right?
I don't know that we're... Because we don't get taught these lessons in school. We don't get taught explicitly about classism and racism and heteronormativity. We don't get taught about these things. So if you're never able to unpack it and analyze it, you just are it.
Yeah.
Just walking around it, right? And so to your point, do I have compassion? Yes, because we all have these blind spots.
Yeah.
We all have these ignorances that would keep us from living our best lives and being our best selves to one another mm-hmm. and for ourselves, mm-hmm. right? We've internalized all of these isms to the point where we act them out of ignorance.
Yeah.
Yeah, so and I'm not calling anyone ignorant. No. because I just every system, in my opinion, is meant to reify and reinforce societal norms. Our societal norms are classist, right. racist, sexist, right. homophobic. Like these are our societal norms. And so until we decide that we're gonna collectively do the work to interrogate those systems, mm-hmm. we can't begin to dismantle them. And these things are going to continue to happen over and over.
So do you see us interrogating those systems? Do you see us even beginning the process of recognizing what's wrong and what not just causes this, but as you point out, reinforces it over and over in a way that would send us in a different direction. This is the question about hope that I ask everybody. Do you have any hope at all?
Well, you're doing this work, right? And so, yeah, even raising awareness or having someone like me, a critical race theorist, when people are like, oh my God.
I know. You said that and I was like, oh, now no one's going to listen.
Yeah. No, but that's serious though, for real. Like some people think that that's the boogeyman, right?
The conservatives have done a great job of absolutely
not reading critical race theory,
right? Not understanding what it is, and then assigning a false narrative to it that has stuck in so many people's minds. I mean, people believe what they've said about it now.
Yeah, so now you go back to that hope question. If we would read, I think we have
if we could
hope.
Read and
yes,
comprehend.
If we would just read, we would know, and not just read critical race theory. Obviously, that's like I didn't know anything about critical race theory until I was in my PhD program. But read about the world from other people's perspectives.
Yeah.
read about it from your own perspective,
right?
Like I, as a child, read Man-Child in the Promised Land and Langston Hughes and Toni Morrison and, I just read.
And what led you to that reading list rather than other things? Was it your parents? Was it your school? Was it your peers? Where did you get that?
No. So So my mom was one of those parents who, just like all the other parents that we know, right? Strict, you better not mess up in school. Mm-hmm. If I got to come off my job,
right?
Pick a switch, right? Like it's going to be a problem for you. So I couldn't get bad grades. Like C was for a chokehold in my house. Like you can get A's and B's, but that C is going to get you hemmed up. So I already decided that I wanted to live and I was going to do well in school, but I like to read. And so I read everything. Judy Blume, right? Dennis the Menace, the Hardy Boys. I read everything until eighth grade. I came up on like Little House on the Prairie, the whole series. I came on Malcolm X's autobiography in eighth grade. And what it did for me was explain my condition. It explained.
You could see yourself.
And I could see myself in a larger narrative. Mm. It wasn't me, Rima, experiencing racism in rural Michigan. My brother and I, the two black kids at the school, right? Wasn't me by myself experiencing racism. This was a global experience.
Right.
And I was one of many. And that empowered me. Like, it's not because, you know, my breath stinks or, you know, I don't look cute or whatever it is. The rejection is part of a systemic issue that is global.
This is not about me.
Man, it was freeing. I felt emancipated. And so at that point, I started to read everyone black that I could read. Mm. Right. I read W.E.B. Du Bois. Like as a young child, I'm just absorbing all I can to explain my condition. I wanted to know who I was.
Right.
And knowing who we are explains who I am.
Yeah.
So the school certainly did not, right? I was reading the Hardy Boys before that.
I was joking about school.
Which I wish we have one of the blackest cities in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
One of the blackest districts in the United States. If we decided, and I think it's slowly happening, to your point of hope, if we decided that we were going to teach very intentionally who we are, whose we are, and who we're becoming, we would see a difference in Detroit that reverberates across, not even to just the nation, right? We're in Ghana. We're everywhere. Detroiters are everywhere. I saw some Detroiters in Ghana this summer.
Right? Right, you could go anywhere without running into someone from Detroit.
And where would the world be without Detroit?
Yeah, that's right.
Let's be clear.
Yeah.
You can't go anywhere without Motown. Where? On the whole planet.
True.
So if we knew how bad, meaning good, this place is, and we instilled that in every child, every teacher, every judge, we would just have a different world.
Yeah.
And we could do that easily.
Yeah.
You change schools, you change the whole world. And that judge, Eva Goodman, the mom, the Greening Project, all those people had to go through school.
That's
every
true.
Single one.
That's
it's
true.
Mandated.
Yeah.
That's the place of intervention. If we want to just reproduce something else, right? Stop this mass reproduction of inequality.
Mm-hmm.
Inject some inequity, some equity work and some equality work. That is the point of intervention. Schools, we all have to go through it. What we decide to do or not do then creates an Eva Goodman.
Yeah. Okay, we need to take another quick break. We'll be back with more Created Equal.
You
listening to Created Equal from WDET in Detroit. I'm Stephen Henderson, and I'm talking today with Dr. Rima Vassar. She is a professor of educational leadership and policy studies at Wayne State University. We're talking about the way we react when we see someone who is in distress because of poverty. Let's get back to our conversation. How do you know if a child is demonstrating these kinds of behaviors that it's not disrespect? I mean, sometimes it is. Sometimes you've got someone who is not in the right frame of mind. And this judge King read it that way. He could have been right, I suppose. And let's put aside for a second what he decided to do, which was inappropriate, whether he was right or wrong. But the way he read it could have been true.
No.
No.
Could not. Right?
Could not have been true.
Could not. Because, all behavior is functional.
Is functional. Right.
Every
it's
single
a reflection
thing.
Of something else.
Yes. If you're in a bad mood, don't you get to be in a bad mood? Like
someone or something put you in that space.
And let me have my moment and move on with my life. Like, why are you on me? Right?
Right,
like,
right.
Teachers get to come in and say, I haven't had my coffee. Don't bother me for 5 minutes, right? Teachers can do this.
Right.
Judge can say, I got to take a recess. I need to, you know, compose myself and come back or get some lunch and come back. Why aren't children allowed to do that? Why can't children say, hey, I'm tired.
And I had a rough night.
And obviously this is not, you know, I read too that she had just been in court for something else. And so this was a traumatic experience for her anyway. But even if it weren't that, you're not interesting, sir. I'm not going into law.
This is not what I want to do.
I'm rather tired. I would prefer to nap.
Yeah.
Why does that bother you?
Why is that a big deal?
It's not, right? It's really not. That we police the bodies of young people in a way that's inhumane is problematic. The way we police those who are living in poverty is problematic.
Yeah.
And the way we police Black folks at every age is problematic. In every bracket.
Yes.
You just talked about
being
in handcuffs.
Yeah.
I've been pulled over
and
looking like a church lady. And searched illegally my vehicle, my body. And Sandra Bland had just gotten killed. And I was in the back of that squad car for no reason. Like, literally, I got no ticket. No ticket. Like, slow down was what he said when he finally let me out of the squad car.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm praying the whole time, like, just let him see me as a full human being. Just let him see me.
Right.
Because he was looking past me as he was talking to me, like I wasn't there.
Yeah.
Just let him see me. And when he let me go, the hardest thing that when I remember this, is I wanted to thank him. When he had illegally searched my body and my vehicle, I wanted to thank him for releasing me. But I did ask him, because I'm a researcher, why are you letting me go? Like, what happened here? Because I didn't have, I was speeding. He could have given me a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you mentioned that you were a teacher in all of my pleadings. I'm a teacher. I don't have a gun. What are you doing? Like, he said, you mentioned you were a teacher and my daughter's a teacher. There was just one
connection, one little thing that connected him to you as a human being.
For him to see me
as
human. He said, I love teachers. And he said, you let me go. That's how we need to look at people. From the onset, these are human beings. She's having a bad day. Kids don't come to school to terrorize the school and cuss people out. There's a reason they're responding to their environment generally.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
And their experiences, right?
Yes. Yeah. What is it? What can we do to help, to come alongside and assist and love and nurture and grow you? Not punish, humiliate, and shame. So no. I think I can't remember your question, but the answer that I had was no.
Right.
It's not
there
disrespect.
There is not disrespect, right?
All behavior is functional.
It's not the way to read it.
Figure it out.
Yeah.
And move in love.
What should he have done? What should have been his reaction to this situation?
When a child is sleeping, just let the child sleep, right? That's what I would say. And if you had a real concern, this is a field trip, let's be clear, not a scared straight exercise, right? Like, this is a field trip. You could talk to the directors afterwards, like, you know, because he's not in charge of these children. The directors who came and brought them.
She was on a field trip. There were people who were there responsible for her.
And he could have reached out to the other adults to say, you know, this is how I was
feeling.
What's
going on with this kid?
Yeah, did you notice? And maybe you want to follow up with that child, right? But there wasn't a place for me that he could have intervened in the way that he did. Talk to the other adults. This is an issue of a child and how children behave, right? The decision-making processes that students have, we're expecting to have adult, and when I say adult, I'm talking 28, 29-year-old responses to the environment. And it's just not realistic. And so when I was a teacher, I sent up two referrals the whole time, two referrals. And they were fighting in my classroom, and the security had to come and break up the fight. Mm-hmm. And so I had to write the referral, right? But was I called a hard one time? Yes, right? Someone say, I can't believe you gave me
so you wrote me up.
Yeah, you gave me an F minus, and you called my dad, and that was some... Like, I got all of this in as a teacher. I didn't write those kids up. I only had to when other people were involved. This is a classroom. It's a sanctuary. We're trying to figure out how to learn together.
Yeah.
I'm not here to police you. And you're having a bad day. I understand. I don't talk to you like that. Don't talk to me like that. We move on.
Yeah.
I'm not taking it personally. My esteem can never be in the hands of an adolescent.
Yeah, right.
Do you that's know how great, dangerous?
That's a great point. Right? No matter what they do, what does it have to do with me?
Do you know what kind of trauma you're inflicting on yourself if you decide that what an adolescent says to you is going to stick?
Right. I think most parents understand that.
I would never. So the esteem comes from working through human emotions, right? The human experience that we're all having. That's where your self-esteem comes from. Where that kid who cussed me out because I gave him an F minus, I was like, you have a 13% though, sir. Which actually means that I had a 13% because I'm the teacher.
You're teaching, right?
Or I'm not, yeah. Right? If no one's learning, then someone's not teaching. So right. I had a 13% too. It's an indictment on me because they're codependent. Teaching and learning are reciprocal.
Yes.
You're not teaching. You're just presenting some information if kids aren't learning. That's another aside. But I gave him a 13%. His dad went off on him. He went off on me. Later, that kid challenged me and bet me that he could get an A in my class. Hmm. He got an A.
Yeah.
I had to get my tongue pierced for that, by the way. That was
the bet.
That was the bet. Oh, but once I got that tongue pierced, which was horrible.
I'm not sure I would have made that bet.
I never thought he had a 13%.
You're like, he has no shot of winning this bet.
No shot. He got a 90% in that class for that semester. That was the first grading reporting was that 13%. He worked his little butt off. And so Garrett Sanchez, once I got that piercing, was my biggest fan. He was my teacher assistant the next year, right? So he's telling people you're going to get a 13% if you don't get it.
Right.
He was my biggest fan after he cussed me clean out about that 13%, his dad cussing him out, right? We're all redeemable. None of this is personal, right? Learn to love through all of this.
Yeah.
And make that the center. Like, that's your first thought is, oh, this isn't about me. What's wrong?
Yeah.
And how can I fix it?
Yeah. Yeah.
What's my role?
Right. What can I do?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Dr. Rima Vassar, this was really great to have you here. Thanks so much for joining us on Created Equal.
I enjoyed myself.
This was great.
I was really nervous at first. Like, what is he going to ask me? But it was
not
easy.
An interview. It's a conversation.
It was a conversation.
That'll do it for this edition of Created Equal. Remember, you can listen to recent episodes of the show at WDET.org. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And while you're there, don't forget to subscribe and to rate the show. You can also leave us a review. Created Equal is produced by Kerry Jr. II and David Lines. Our audio editing is by Connor Anderson, and the music is by Sam Bobian. Our digital team is David Kim, Jenny Sherman, and Sophia Joswiak. Our program director is Adam Fox. Created Equal is a production of WDET, a listener-supported service of Wayne State University. If you like what you hear from our WDET programming, please support the station. We are always taking donations.